time it takes for the detector to do its thing. Not an easy problem. And when you do find the solution, Bob, we're all going to be interested in this because the smarter people who listen to all of us are starting to add CO2 detectors and smoke detectors to their house because it's going to be quite a lifesaver. Mel, I bet you've got some comments on this one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I'll tell you, I've had a lot of success with filters on AC line by salvaging a lot of electronic junk that's thrown out, like monitors, computers, and all. You open them up, and they, right inside the case, as the AC enters the case, you know, they have those fancy plugs now, three-pin plugs. Right on the other side of it, usually mounted in many cases, even right up against it, is a nice little filter circuit of toroids, condensers, and all kinds of little chockies in there. I've taken them out. I always find things. And I've salvaged a lot of stuff off, junk computers and things, monitors and all, good sorts of small parts, fans and things. I looked at the filters that they have right on the AC line. And I've taken them out and used them, and seems like they seem to work pretty good, Dick. I guess at HF frequencies, like say 80, 40, and 20, most everything works fairly well. But there's a good source of, a filter, and you can twiddle with it or whatever it is, if you get it for nothing, over.
Yeah, give me a couple of words on the filter itself. So, you being the scientist you are, Mel, I'm pretty sure you didn't just look at it as a black box. I bet you some of them are an open frame, and you actually see what's there. Do you see ferrite toroid coils? Do you see bypass capacitors to a local ground? Or what do you actually see when you look at that filter, Mel? Go ahead.
Roger, exactly. Look at it. Two wires coming off the plug, off the inside receptacle. Usually I can have like a nice wire, looks like at least number 14 wire, stranded wire. And usually, for some reason, they pick yellow and blue. I don't know. I've seen a lot of yellow and blue wires that they use. I don't know why they have to pick those two colors. Of course, the ground is green. And they twist them through. They do two turns, I think, on two turns, yeah, through a toroid. Nice, hefty little toroid with a good 3/4 inch open circle at the donut, and a wall thickness of maybe at least of an eighth of an inch, and a thickness of the toroid itself, flat part of it, about a quarter of an inch. And then there's nice little condensers and an MOB. They stick an MOB on it, and you got yourself a nice little network. I can say I've used them a few times. They seem to do quite well. Quite amazed. Open. They're mostly open. Hanging. In fact, they're supported by the wires, usually to to a tie point or something. They're not encased. A few of them I found encased, but those were on the cord itself. This is a funny thing. Sony was using on their TV set, the regular TVs, before this, not the flat panel jobs, but their regular TV. They had one right on the AC line as you plug it in the wall. They had this real Gewinde thing potted. And I busted open one to see, and the whole fancy network in there is mostly filter or whatever coming up the AC line. But you don't see that anymore. Now it's stuck inside the box. It doesn't seem to be as elaborate the ones that I find inside now, computers, monitors and all. But still seems to be, something that they've taken some workmanship to, something in the way of most likely some engineering to come up with this, because they do have a number of nice little parts hanging on there in that network, Dick, over.
Yeah, this is a very crafty thing to do, Mel, because the price is right. During the days you have pickup from your garbage man, almost every one of those days, I'll see somebody throwing out an old computer, a monitor device, whatever. Almost all of these have the kind of filter you're talking about. And the filter is there for two reasons. One, they want the computer not to be affected by any local RF that can be picked up by the wiring. But the main reason the filter is there is to protect everything else in the house. your high-voltage power supply, which is a switching regulator on any of the old-fashioned monitors that had a cathode ray tube, it is a very strong electromagnetic interference generator, an EMI generator. And if that signal is generating, gets coupled into the 110-volt line, it's going to make all kinds of squiggly lines across your television screen. So those filters are there to protect the world from the signals being created inside of the monitor or inside of the computer. But the filter is a two-way street. In other words, that which filters on what's going out is also going to filter on that which comes back in. So because every one of us sees monitors being thrown away and computers being thrown away, and you check with your buddies, even if you don't find one, if a guy happens to work for a good-sized company, I go to a particular salt mine where every couple of months I will see the whole lined up with 15 or 20 computers, which are about 4 years old, 5 years old, because the company decided to upgrade to more modern flat screens or whatever, and they literally are throwing away all the other old computers, and they're going to a recycling house somewhere that's going to take the gold and the lead and whatever out of them and the individual components and so on. It's not going straight to a dump site, I'd like to believe. So what I'm getting at is lots of the filters you're talking about are being thrown away free of charge. The price is right. They've got enough power to run a computer, to run the milliwatt or fraction of a watt for a CO2 and smoke detector. It's very easy for that circuit. And to wire that in the line, and to do it with UL-approved technique, I guess you really should have a breakout box. Or can you take an open frame-like thing like that and wire it into the wall? I think you cannot, not legally, unless it has some kind of a heavy plastic around it. An ordinary receptacle box or breakout box is the right way to mount that. If you're installing that into an appliance like a smoke detector, how would you contain it, Mel? I'm going to ask both Mel and anyone else who has an opinion on this. What do you believe is the right way to contain that to be up to code, if you know what I mean? K2KEY first, K2RIW.
TNJ, would a comment then?
K2KEY, basically, when they stick them in the computer monitor and all, it's just hanging there. It's in the plastic cabinet. And if you, a lot of things you see it in, I mean, I take them out of a cable box. They have them in there, too. Why they prepare these numbers of cable boxes they were tossing out. Oh yeah, I scour around, Dick. That's my year. He's taking away my best source of stuff. Well, you can't come to this neighborhood. I have the right to this neighborhood, ain't I? So I pick up stuff all kinds of, oh geez, they throw out all kinds of electronics. Anything I see with electronics, I surely grab. And yeah, the monitors, you look at those older monitors, boy, they got nice shield plates, they got nice tin also inside there, nice pieces of paneling, metal paneling. I also salvage. I salvage almost everything out of it. Chassis comes out, I throw away the picture tube and all, everything like that, but I take the yoke off, got it right there, you know, a million little things I find that I hang on to. They're harder, of course, now that this one disappeared, you know, with the flat panels and stuff and all, but still plenty of it out there, like you say. A lot of it I plugged in, you know, it's funny. I said, you know, before I tear it apart, let me see what the heck is really wrong with this curiosity. How much of this stuff I have plugged in, hooked up, and nothing wrong with it? And I've picked up some beautiful monitors. I've got a few of them here. Modern monitors, you know, like you say, maybe some of them maybe 2 years old or 3 years old, most. Modern design keyboard things. Oh, stuff I've found, Dick, unbelievable. And I could say the way they mount the filter in there, guys are getting off on a tangent, of course. The filter is just hanging by its wires in there, Dick. No shielding or whatever. Just in the box. So I assume that if you take a breakout box, like you say, you shove it in the box, a nice little breakout box, a gem box, should be sufficient, I'm sure, because the way that's made, I'm sure it's sufficient, you know, the wire and everything, and the MOV on there, and the batteries and everything, a good quality, Dick, over.
Yep. And as I said before, the price is right, the quality is high, the filtering is bi-directional. Bob, you want to add some further questions or comments? W2PNJ, go ahead.
The problem we run into on a legal aspect is that that monitor carries a UL listing on it, that entire assembly. Did you pull that component out and you're going to put it into something that's like a gem box or a what we call like a 1900 box, is a four inch square by 8.5 deep. The problem is that device is not UL listed. You install it in a wall, you put it in an attic, and God forbid that thing should cause a fire. You're up for grabs because you're installing a device that's not listed. And professionally speaking, I would not be able to do that because the device itself does not carry a UL label on it.
Yep, I see the legality problem you're bringing to our attention, Bob, which is a little bit troubling. So in the case of a very lightly loaded circuit that's directly wired into your smoke detector, CO2 detector, I don't think there's a problem. However, if I install this in the outlet box, and now I'm plugging various appliances into it, and some of them are much heavier in current drain than what this was designed for, yes, I can see how that's a problem. Now, I'd like to believe this thing in itself, with a light current drain on it, is not a fire hazard. Otherwise, they wouldn't allow it to be inside the plastic package of my computer monitor. Because if my computer monitor catches on fire, that's a lawsuit. So, I guess we're in this gray zone here of, we amateurs do things that are, as far as the laws of physics are concerned, good, but as far as the laws of legality are concerned and code, I guess they're questionable. Very similar to what was going on 20 years ago. All self-respecting amateurs 20 years ago were adding phone patches to their telephone circuit. And in those days, there were very strict rules from Ma Bell and ITT that you weren't allowed to put auxiliary devices onto a phone line. And many amateurs did it. Well, the world has changed an awful lot since then. You can now buy an awful lot of Brand X telephones that are not AT&T, and so not Marbell. And so all of a sudden, the phone circuit became a fair game. We amateurs were very quietly using it years ago, even though it was questionable in legality. So I guess you got to be careful how you use these things, but still, within reason, I think it's the right thing to do. I wonder what you believe is the right way to make this all legal, if it's all possible, Bob. W2PNJ, K2RIW.
I'm going to go with the ferrite. I'll try if I can get a big donut. I'll be at the Limewalk Ham Fest at the end of the month, and I'll do some shopping. And either I could shut the circuit off, pull the Romex out of the box, and give maybe one or two turns to a donut, and then put it back in and wire it up. Or I'll get more of the half-inch hole, the snap-on ferrite, and I'll put two or three more. There's one on it now. I'll add two or three, one right next to the other. I'll try that. K2RIW, W2PNJ. Guys, thanks so much for all the ideas. I'll be on the side.
Yeah, thank you for this beautiful question, Bob, because I think you're not the only person running into this. As time goes on, more and more of us are going to be installing smoke detectors and CO2 detectors. And for us amateurs that run significant amounts of power on 80 to 10 meters, a certain number of them are going to get false alarms when they're on the air. And so the ferrite's the right way to go. Okay, let's see now. Who else did we have? Who did I skip on the list who signed in? Or if anyone else wants to give us their questions or comments, give me a call. That is right now. H-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Yeah, I got that information in the toner if anybody would like it.
We sure would, and I forgot to get back to you, Barry. And to Moonbound, K2LIW.
Okay, this won't take long. The telephone company uses a particular type, and I find it's really quite good. It's the one I told you could put it across 220 volts, doesn't matter. It's actually made on Ronkonkoma, Long Island, New York, right out here in the island, so that's good. The company is called AINES, I ain't making this up. Manufacturing Corporation, Ron Concomo, New York, and it's called a Tone Test Set Model, get this cleaned up a little bit, it's been in my toolbox, 240, Model 240.
Welcome to...
And they also have a hand unit that goes with it, but there's another company that makes a much better one, and in a couple of minutes I'll tell everybody where to get these things. A company called Progressive Electronics makes something called the 200SP, which is the unit you hold in your hand, looking for the tone. And why is that better than the other ones? Because it has a filter in it, which eliminates 60 and 120 cycles completely. So you don't have to be bothered by that if you're looking at something near power lines or something like that. And you get that commonly. Now, the company that sells all this stuff is Jenny Electronics. I don't know if it's such a good idea for me to be giving their phone number out over the air. I don't know if that's kosher. So what I'll do instead is I'll give my phone number out. Anybody that wants to get the phone number of Jenny, just give me a call. My number is 718-327-4952. I hope that helps.
Don, good information. Now, it's overly obvious you're not making money from Jenny Electronics. They've got the product that some of us want to buy. I think it's perfectly all right for you to give us that phone number, Barry. Go ahead.
Okay, then I will have to reach into my wallet, because I call them periodically. Hold on a second.
A question, WB7ABS.
Okay, W7-something-ABF, I think you said. One second. Okay, Jenny Distributors, I have the number here. It's 800-422-6191. 800-422-6191. And they are in Ohio.
Okay, Jenny Distributors. And I presume they have a website. They probably have a nice catalog of all kinds of products that would be of interest to us. WB7, I think it's ABF, Alpha Bravo Foxtrot. Correct me on those call letters, sir. Tell us your name and go right ahead with your question or comment. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. WB7ABF, Whiskey Bravo 7 Alpha Victor Fox. Roberto Rob is the name, Romeo Tula Bravo. I'm enjoying very much this discussion as I have for the past few weeks. And I don't want to stray too much from the topic area, but my question is about optimizing an off-center fed dipole type antenna. And what I'm using here in New York City in Manhattan is such an antenna, 135 foot long, using TV Twinly to feed it. And the only balun I have is the one that came with the MSJ tuner I'm using. And, you know, it's an old topic, but maybe you guys could refer me to a reading or some suggestions to make the thing really, really work well. Again, the antenna is 135 foot long. The feed point is 47 foot from one end, so I know it's not like optimized, but help this give you some ideas. WB7ABF?
Yeah, I was doing some web search recently, Rob, on the ARRL website. If you're a member of ARRL, you have access to all kinds of past articles, and if you do a search on off-center fed dipoles, you're going to find a significant number of articles. Even if you're not an ARRL member, and therefore don't have access to their articles, if you just do a general web search by way of Google for off-center fed dipoles, you're going to find quite a number of articles. And I think there's about two or three reasons that people will feed a dipole off of center. One, you get a different impedance, which is sometimes more desirable. Number two, if you do it just right, the antenna works on multiple bands. However, there's a catch. When you feed a dipole off-center, almost always you have common mode current flowing on your transmission line. If the transmission line has the right dressing, if it goes in the right direction for the right number of feet, that becomes part of the antenna, and the radiation pattern, although it's a little bit more complicated, you've got an antenna that works on multiple bands. So it's a very simple compound device. I mean, what we're developing here is a radiating system. And so in many cases, if the transmission line is part of the radiation, that could be good. If the transmission line becomes hot with RF and it gives you a lot of RF in the shack and gives you extra television interference because your transmission line is going by the neighbor's apartment close to his television set, then that could be bad. So I am kind of curious. why you chose an offset sent dipole, Rob. It's a fascinating subject, and I probably have already told you guys that there is an article I've written. You could say on dipoles, but it's also on the driven element of Yagi's. You can make the impedance of your dipole or of the driven element of your Yagi, which is usually a dipole-like device, you can make that impedance anything from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms, not by changing the way you feed the dipole. Everybody thinks you have to go over to a T-match, a gamma match, a delta match, a folded dipole, I'm trying to think of all the crazy ways that people feed dipoles, with various tuning coils and so on. To actually make the impedance of your dipole anything you want, all you got to do is change the link. That adjusts the resistive component. And if it's if you end up with a non-resonant link, which is not bad, in many cases it's good, yes, you'll have some reactants left over, an inductance or a capacitance. And putting the appropriate shunt reactor, a coil or a capacitor, across the two terminals of the dipole, the problem goes away. So you can make a dipole anything from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms by only adjusting the length and in many cases adding a straight capacitor. There's an article on I've written on this subject that you can read by going to Tom Williams' webpage, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .org, I think it is. And at the bottom of his main webpage, which is intended for microwave ham radio operators, you'll find the K2RIW article on the impedance matching of a dipole. In the case of I'll tell you why there's a very desirable reason to do that, but I'll come back with that after you tell us, Rob. I wonder why you chose off-center fed, and which of the many benefits, and there probably are some others, that you're doing with your apartment set up there in New York City. Whiskey Bravo 3, Alpha Victor Foxtrot, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in group WB7, it's Whiskey Bravo 7, Alpha Victor Fox, Seattle call sign, by the way. Very good, very interesting. I've noted here the WA1MBA.org website and the Tom Williams, and I will look for your article. Well, to be honest with you, and I'm not a super technical person, although I am an extra car ham, it's about 77, you know, vacuum tube gig. It's a convenience. I mean, I have access to the roof, it's big up there, and it's how I'm going to put up the biggest antenna I can find, and it just happened that, well, to be the antenna from my apartment, I could, it was off-centered, it was offset. I had used a 66-foot dipole. I had used a full 8-meter dipole center fed with coax, but I decided to try this operation, and had some TV twin leads, good quality twin lead I bought here in the neighborhood, so I wasn't even tired this day. Was trying to get open wireline from the wireman and whatnot. Had this stuff, excuse me, and had been experimenting. Managed to tweak it so that it would work broadband on 20 meters. Now, I operate CW mostly and QRP. So I became curious about the properties of these antennas, and I've done a little bit of reading. Sometimes the reading's a bit over my head, but I do what I can. And that's basically the story. But now I'm actually interested in optimizing the antenna for broadband work. So I will appreciate any input, and again, I will make reference to the article you mentioned to me. My question, I guess, would be more just to this idea of the balun, the famous balun of various different ratios, and these toroids with shunts, various energies, and I wonder if they're really all that necessary or important. In terms of operability and functionality, the thing works great through the old MFJT transmatch. I'm able to even load up on 160 and do well. So, I mean, why fix something that's not broken? But I would like to optimize this type of antenna. I hope this makes sense. K2RIW and group WB7ABF.
It sure does make a lot of sense, Rob. For an amateur to optimize his antenna, study his antenna, figure out how it works, how to make it work better, and once again, to understand it makes a lot of sense. The wireless world is useless without antennas. That's an overly obvious question, a statement. I mean, your transmitter can be the biggest and the best gold-plated transmitter ever made. Your receiver can be the best receiver ever made. And if each of those are not connected to a reasonable antenna, you're going to get poor performance. The antenna is the common denominator of all. And to understand it is a very reasonable thing to do. every one of us, as an amateur radio operator, realizes there's some kind of magic going on inside the antenna that we only partially understand. I'm a consulting electronic engineer. I've had a private consulting business since 2000 when I retired from Airborne Instruments Laboratory after working for 35 years as an engineer, sort of a consultant within the company. Now I'm doing it professionally. And the majority of my work throughout those 35 years has been on antennas. I now have, 15 or 16 patent applications. Some of them have already been granted with my name on them, on antenna patents. And so you'd say, hey, this guy RIW is really involved with antennas. You'd say, gee, he must really understand them. Well, I wish I had more understanding. When it comes to building antennas that work over certain frequency ranges with certain standing wave ratios and certain patterns, I've got a fair amount of experience and a certain amount of understanding. What really happens at the molecular level, what really happens in free space, still is a bit of a mystery to me. I built an antenna in 1971 that allowed me to listen to the Apollo astronauts directly, the 2,000 meg signal, on Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 that was being transmitted from the moon back to Goldstone. I listened to that signal directly with my own equipment, with equipment that I set up at AIO at the time. And so the way the antenna works, the way it has enough gain, enough noise figure, enough pattern, and so on, I thought I understood all of that. But what really took place? I do know that when that 10-watt transmitter was turned on the lunar surface, and an astronaut talked over that circuit, I know that not one single electron left the moon and hit my antenna in Farmingdale, Long Island. Yet I'm listening to that signal, okay? What was that signal? Now we call it a wave. We can call it photons. We can call it corpuscles. We can say it travels through the ether. It travels through the medium. Well, what is that medium? There's a hard vacuum between the Earth and the moon, and nothing is there. So before the astronaut on the moon turned on the transmitter, nothing was there. During the time he's running the transmitter, nothing is there. And after he's finished transmitting, nothing is there. Not one single electron. Some kind of an electromagnetic wave traversed that distance, that quarter of a million mile distance. And it's like the word virus. We got a word, we got a name for it, and therefore we think we understand it. What really moved? I'm still kind of investigating that, you could say. I'm still curious. What really did it? And so I know how to make them work well. I don't know what they do. And so anything you find out about antennas and how they work, Rob, please come back and tell us what your research tells us. WB3AVF. That's WB7AVF. Can't even read my own writing. K2RIW. You got it, Rob.
K2RIW, WB7AVF. Intriguing, indeed. That's really mind-boggling. That's one of the cool things about ham radio. Indeed, those are special moments. And you're actually able to pick up that signal from the moon. Pretty awesome. Yeah, well, I will investigate. Again, I'm in music, by the way, in case you've looked at my website. So, yeah, I'm involved in music composition, another abstract and bizarre area of activity, which involves a lot of mystery, you know. It affects us all, but we aren't quite sure how it all really works. But I will investigate this matter, and again, we'll look into these small loop receiving antennas that you guys have been talking about, because I remember my old helicopter's SX-28, back in Seattle, I had that hooked up to a receiving loop antenna. It worked great. So I'm thinking, you know, hey, there's got to be a way to have the best of both worlds. I mean, I know much less than any of you guys. I'm not an electronic engineer by any means, but I'm intrigued by the various possibilities. Perhaps some of this older technology can be brought back. So I will look on the LIMOC website. I'm looking here right now, and check out some of the older stories. Won't hold the frequency and won't tie you guys down with this sort of speculation. And thanks so much for the tip and the insight. And again, I'll be on the side here. WB7EDS. Thank you.
Yeah, Rob, you said you're going to go to the LIMOC website. I think you meant the ARRL website, American Radio Relay League. They've got quite a few articles on off-center fed dipoles, as will a regular Google search. Will you find a LIMOC website article on off-center fed dipoles? Well, wait a minute now. I guess the Limon website does have a number of links to other websites that will give you information. One way or another, you're going to find out a lot. Do come back and let us know what you find out. But by the way, on the subject of music, which is related to ham radio operation, because a guy who is listening to Morse code, and he's listening to that weak tone in the noise, he's using some very elaborate qualities of the human hearing system. I'm convinced that the human hearing system was designed as a defensive tool. In other words, by way of the direction finding and the spectrum analysis, you can recognize, early mankind could recognize that the lion that's in the woods that's walking toward him. He's got a certain characteristic sound, and if you can figure out how far away he is, what direction he is, and whether or not he's a threat, you better be moving in the other direction real fast, or you're about to become a meal. And so the left and right side of your hearing system has a thoroughly independent audio spectrum analyzer, ubiquitous spectrum analyzer. In other words, it receives all tones simultaneously and figures out the ratios of those tones and the ratios of the time of arrival and the phase difference between left ear and the right ear. Very elaborate system. Why in the world did Mother Nature design something so elaborate? And it's because it's a defensive tool. But once you've got that defensive tool with all of those great characteristics, when you are listening to music or you're listening to Morse code, you're playing with the fact that this system between your ears has such extremely high capability. Part of the music appreciation, and I'm not convinced that Mother Nature designed that acoustic system inside of a human being in order for us to appreciate music. I'm not convinced that in our early days that was a survival mechanism, although I could be wrong there. I think it was more to listen to other sounds. But once you've got this system and you can play with it, and that's what music is doing. You've got a whole lot of various tones and various durations and magnitudes, sweeping in various ways. That's what music is, in my mind. The system allows you to analyze that and say, yeah, I like that. And when you say, I like that, what does that really mean? And when you say certain music is dissonant or harmonic, and when you're listening to a B-flat seventh diminished chord, and it has a certain response to a human being, what in the world is that? Give us a couple of words on that one, Rob, if you happen to have that one figured out. So V7AVF, K2RIW.
K2RIW and group WB7AVF. All right, well, this is, it's a related deal, you know. Remember, music is part of the quadrivium in the Middle Ages, and architecture and sonic study were considered very important. It's not just speculation. Absolutely. Well, you know, music and it's is a very powerful vehicle or medium for transmitting ideas or emotions or anything you want to say. I mean, it's directly working upon the brain. So whatever adjectives or qualifiers you want to use, good, bad, ugly, dissonant, are pretty culturally relevant. Okay, I'm not going to go into that area, but for sure, sound and polyphony work upon it. And I would recommend anyone who likes any kind of music, whether it's rock, heavy metal, you know, classical, jazz, pop, to listen keenly and realize that these combinations of timbres and frequencies moving at different rates are actually affecting us neurologically in profound ways. And what can I say? I mean, Galileo Galilei is considered one of the great geniuses, you know, Michael Faraday. I would put J.F. Bach right up there because here's a guy who was able to combine several strands of polyphony together in, quote, apparently dissonant ways, and yet coherent whole is something that we consider, quote, unquote, beautiful. Each individual line is disjointed, highly dissonant by any measure of more traditional melodic construction, you know, more traditional melodic construction based on folk music or pop music of any world, yet together in harmony, they create an effect upon the listeners. The mind, the musical mind is a very powerful thing. It's a non-verbal thing. It's just something else to talk about, and I want to bore people with it. But there is a relationship, and those of us who are musicians who enjoy CW, I probably enjoy it for that, because CW isn't really music, and I don't think it's really a language, but it is a code, and it is a code that requires keen hearing. And, of course, I don't think they've developed software yet that can transcribe the fist of an individual operator, and I think that's one of the great, delightful things about CW, is that you really do get a feel for the person, the fist of that person sending to you, even when they use a keyer. But what exactly is that feel? And again, what exactly is that thing, that signal moving through the ether from the moon to the earth? Anyway, relaxing philosophically, I will now just listen on the side here. Thanks a lot for the tips there. K2RIW and group WB7, AVF New York.
Very fine, Rob. when I was more heavily using Morse code in my earlier ham radio days, most of my friends, I could recognize them immediately when they sent about five letters. We all have a certain characteristic way that we send Morse code, not too different than your signature. Many of your friends you can recognize by the way they write a particular word on a page with script. So there's a lot of personality, and can you devise a computer program that can recognize those individual characteristics? Don, interesting question. Can you make a computer program that does pattern recognition and can recognize the difference of faces that are quite similar? I mean, your cousin, your brother, and your father may have a very similar face, and if you take a picture of them all at a similar age, you can see the difference. Could you write a computer program to do that? There's another defensive mechanism built into human beings where facial recognition is very important. You have to be able to recognize your mother, because she's the person you're going to go back to as a young person that's going to defend you, supply nourishment, whatever. She has to be able to recognize. You watch that program about penguins in Antarctica, when the mother goes away for a long period of time to feed herself and comes back, and she's coming back to a crowd of 50,000 penguins, and she lets out a squawk, and her particular child recognizes that particular voice immediately in that cacophony of tens of thousands of others. When a bat is flying out of a cave, and he's got 10,000 bats flying with him, and he's doing all this echoing in the dark, he recognizes the echoes of his particular chirps compared to all the others. Fantastic. Great stuff. Okay. We're getting pretty far afield here. I guess we should find out what's going on in space. Hey, Paul, I think, tell us what's going on. WS2N. Hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. And good last topic, too. Very good. Dick, quite a few things. I'll just go through them briefly, and then if you want to go over it, I think maybe that would be the best thing to do. Over, something a little bit more in detail. The Dawn spacecraft, which we talked about, I started talking about that back in July, and then it was delayed, and it only went up in the end of September. They tested the ion engines, had three of them on board. It is in space and on its way to a 2011 orbit of an asteroid. Bring people up to date that haven't been following that. And then future plans after that will be to deorbit that asteroid and go to another asteroid in 2015. And the ion engines that they're using, not the first time it's been done, but first time they have three on board, they are functioning well. So I thought I'd bring you back up to speed on the Dawn spacecraft, doing well. We just passed the 50th anniversary of the Sputnik launch. There was a good article in QST last month regarding that topic. But here we are 50 years later after Sputnik, and we're still still talking about the space program. We're still talking about ham radio. A lot of hams listen to the October 4th, 57 launch of Sputnik, and where that's gotten us today, all these years later. It's really amazing, creating the space race, and now I think we're going to get into another space race eventually with China. So I thought I'd bring that up. Talking about the Russians, there's this fella, Richard Garriott, his name is. And he's the son of Owen Garriott. Now, Owen Garriott is a ham. And he's, was on board Skylab and Blue One, the space shuttle. Well, his son now, Richard Garriott, who has a lot of money, is going to get a ride to the International Space Station next October, a year from now. on board a Soyuz spacecraft. He's going to pay $30 million for this, and he's going to be trained to actually be an astronaut. So, or I guess you would call him a cosmonaut. But he's the would be the first time a son of an astronaut or any child of an astronaut will be going up into orbit there. Now this guy, he made his money in some kind of computer game. I don't know any details on it, but $30 million, a lot of money. It used to be $20 million. I guess it went up. Inflation is... It must be costing more money to put those Soyuz rockets up in space, Dick. And then thought I'd mention the James Webb Infrared Telescope. We've talked about that before. Last I read, they're testing out these heat shields. You know, these heat shields on this telescope, you know, you've got this massive telescope, three times the size of the Hubble Space Telescope, and it needs these gigantic heat shields. Even though it's going to be a million miles away from Earth, they want to keep this thing as cold as possible. Idea is to keep it as close to absolute zero as possible, because any kind of heat coming off the spacecraft, or God forbid the sun gets pointed at the thing, that would definitely interfere with the 3 degree Kelvin temperatures that they're trying to get from outer space to, it just won't work. So any infrared spacecraft needs some kind of protection from the heat, and this thing's got a heat shield the size of a tennis court. So they're trying to figure out how to best unfurl this thing to protect the spacecraft once it's out 1 million miles away. It's got to work right because they can't bring it back. I remember talking about that on the net as well. Not coming back. That will be flown in 2013. I'd also like to bring up Peggy Weitzman. She's an astronaut who's now commanding the International Space Station, or will be taking over, I guess, docked with the space station launch from the Kazakhstan. You know where it's the Baikonur space. Trying to think of the name of the country. Well, that went out of my head. But you know, it's the Russian launch facility, and she's now going to be the first woman commander aboard the International Space Station. She's been up there before. Spent 6 months on the space station as a crew member back in, quite a few years ago. She was on Expedition 7, now they're up to Expedition 16. So, that's another first. And of course, we've got one more launch, maybe hopefully another launch by the end of the year, but we do have another launch coming up October 23rd. For the STS-120, I know we've talked about that before. That's going to be bringing up the Harmony node, they call it, a six-sided structure, six openings on it, to be connected to the International Space Station, where you'll have the ability to attach other labs and modules that'll be blown up in the air, not too distant future. So that's a big component, 14 feet in diameter, maybe 23 feet long, 30,000 pounds, weighs 10 times more than my car, you know, big thing. And they'll also be relocating that solar array that's been up there since 2000 and putting it in its proper location at the end of the space station, the P6 structure, they call that, with its... complimentary solar array. And that's pretty much it, Dick. If you want to go over anything in detail, we'll do that. Back to you, K2RIW, WS2N.
It turns out that seeing the International Space Station with a ground-based telescope is an extremely difficult thing to do. It rips across your horizon in 18 minutes, which really means that it's a horizon to horizon in something like 18 minutes if it goes straight overhead at 17,500 miles an hour at, I guess it's now something like 220 nautical miles in altitude. It sweeps by very, very fast. So to resolve it, you need a very high-gain telescope. A very high-gain telescope gives you very small angular field of view. Therefore, you need an extremely elaborate tracking system to track it. I don't know of anyone building a tracking system that will track it, giving you a continuous image. However, what a couple of astronomical smart guys have done, I'm a member of the ASLI, Astronomical Society of Long Island. Every so often somebody will put out an article of a guy who has taken a picture of the International Space Station as it swept across the sun. So he's got a sun filter on his telescope. He's got a telescope aimed at a particular portion of the sun, and he's got very careful timing. The International Space Station trips across the sun, and I think it's like a quarter of a second. So you run a very high-speed motion picture camera, the electronic equivalent, on the eyepiece of your telescope aimed across the sun, and if you're real lucky, you'll catch a very nice glimpse of the International Space Station against the sun. What makes that picture so interesting is that as a silhouette, it's very sharp. You've got a very bright background lighting it, namely the sun. And when you go to the right website, you see some of these pictures. Some of them are awful, awful good. Now, when it comes to the James Webb telescope, in the past I've mentioned the fact that it's going to be at the Lagrange point, one of those stable points in space, a million miles away from the Earth, on the opposite side from the sun. So it's going to be four times the distance of the moon away from the Earth, and the backside of the Earth, so to speak. And it'd be nice to think that the Earth is acting as a shield between the sun and the Webb Space Telescope. Well, the way that Lagrange point drifts around, in other words, the spacecraft there doesn't sit absolutely still with reference to the Earth-Sun system. There's a kind of drifting around that takes place, and every so often, the spacecraft will peak around the side of the Earth, and sunlight will directly be hitting it. That's the reason why they're going to put up that shield that I think you said is about the size of a tennis court. And to your knowledge, is the main detector on the Webb telescope, is it going to be using cryogenics, like liquid nitrogen and liquid helium, in which case that's a consumable, which means you'll get great sensitivity for a while, and when you use that consumable, you'll have less sensitivity, or to have some techniques by which you can do space cooling. In other words, you somehow couple your detecting device to the 3-degree Kelvins of space, and if you do a real efficient job of doing that, your electronics runs at something close to 3 degrees Kelvin. I wonder if they've ironed out some of those details. Let me pass that one back to you, Paul, on just that question alone. WS2N, K2LIW.
I know they've flown quite a few infrared telescopes up, and they always use cryogenics. But this thing, I saw a good show on the History Channel regarding the James Webb infrared telescope, and they talked about, actually what the show was about cryogenics, but and how that's really helped industry all throughout the years, and they finished up with this telescope, and they talked about just using273.15, I think is absolute zero on the centigrade scale. Just slightly above that, if they want to keep it 3 degrees, and they're able to do this by, you knock out that whole sun with the shield, and look out to the darkness, to the stars. You're only going to get the heat off of those stars, those planets that they'll be looking for that spectrum.
That's going to be a fascinating picture. Webb, as I see it, is above the atmosphere, which is partially opaque to infrared energy and creates a lot of distortion. It's larger than Hubble, in some respects more sensitive than Hubble, with state-of-the-art cryogenics on board, or as far as cryogenically cooled detector system, whether it's done with liquids boiling off that it's consumable, or if it's done with a Stirling engine. My guess is it's not going to be a Stirling engine, because that's got a finite lifetime. And my guess is they're going to try to use something better than consumables, because that's also got a finite lifetime. And there's no repair capability. It's too far away. The Hubble can't get there. Building a robot that goes there to repair it is essentially out of the question. So this great telescope, you'd like it to work for a whole lot of years. Hubble was never intended to work for a number of years that it has, and I hope they finally do go back and do another repair, because it's one of the most productive pieces of hardware NASA has ever built. Fascinating about the fact that Rich Garriott is going to be going up next year. Owen Garriott, I can't remember his call letters now, W5 or K5. I should know his call letters. In theory, I talked to him in 1985 while he was on the space shuttle. There were three people on Long Island that managed to have a so-called QSO, which really means I called his call letters, and he recognized that in the tape recording he played back. I wouldn't call that a very nice conversation with Owen. Owen and I met face-to-face. I've got a picture of him and I shaking hands with each other as part of that advertisement I have when I was running a lawsuit against the... it was a zoning case against my town because they wanted me to remove my tower. And along came Hurricane Gloria, and I helped out the town, and all of a sudden it decided that, gee, maybe we shouldn't do that. And it was a whole misunderstanding. So Owen and I have met, and in theory we've talked, although it wasn't a real conversation. If I was King Hussein of Jordan, and he flew over my territory, and you have a private conversation between the two over ham radio, without a doubt. But when Owen Garriott's in the space shuttle flying over the United States, and he's looking at a 3,000-mile diameter of humanity all at once, and half of that humanity is ham radio operators in the United States all shouting to him at the same time, that's a real pileup. That's a real bedlam. You don't hold much of a conversation in a situation like that. So fascinating that his son has done so well. There's another thing I was going to mention. Oh, yeah, those ion engines that are on the Dawn spacecraft. Not everybody understands that ion engines are used because they have fantastically higher efficiency. The only way you can propel yourself in space is you have to throw mass in some direction. There's got to be the equivalent of a rocket exhaust. There's no other way you can move yourself in space. And as such, the faster you can throw the material coming out of the equivalent of the nozzle of the rocket engine, the more efficiency you get. And so with ion propulsion, where you're using very light, not very much material, but you're throwing it out at close to the speed of light is what you'd like to be able to do. You couldn't possibly get material coming out of a rocket engine that fast because the nozzle would have to run too hot and you'd be melting down the nozzle. Whereas with an ion engine, I think you can get something like 30 times more efficiency than you can out of a chemical engine. And I believe the Dawn spacecraft is going to be using its ion engine for, isn't it like a year or two continuously, in order to get it into the right orbit to meet the first asteroid, and then to break out of that orbit and go to the second asteroid. Tremendous amounts of runtime on that rocket engine, of that ion engine is going to take place. And there's some... If you go to the right NASA site on that, it's a beautiful explanation for what's going on. There's some websites I've discovered recently that give a lot of very good space information on many of these subjects. Does anyone else want to ask Paul for further fill on any of the material he just gave us? Give me your call letters right now, KQRIW in the TechNet. Okay. Nobody any further questions? And so, Mel, I know you've got a pretty full mailbag of emails of the questions you get. That plus what those guys in the Kings County Radio Club are doing. Probably most of you know that Mel is the president or the... I think he's the president. He's the deputy grandmaster and president of the Kings County Radio Club. And so a good group of guys that periodically, from time to time, they hold a shootout at Floyd Bennett Field, in which they compare various kinds of mobile antennas. They have a pretty big operation when it comes to the field day site. Whenever field day is taking place, you go to Floyd Bennett Field, and you go to the Ryan Visitor Center, I think it's called, and you visit his group of guys, you'll see a significant setup, and I think they've been doing that for at least 10 or 15 years, to my knowledge. And I sometimes visit them and see that particular operation. So what have you guys been doing, and what kind of mail you've been getting? Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay. Hang on again. This is K2KEY. Yeah, fine business, Dick. Thank you for the plug there for the KTRC. A grand bunch of guys, like you say, and we always do have a nice field day, and I guess we spent a number of them together. Let's see. Oh, far, let me make some comments first. You asked why there are any more platers around. A couple of platers here in Brooklyn, why they go out of business. At one time, the platers that did here, copper plating, silver plating, oh, they kept pretty busy. They were doing all kinds of jobs. They used to be able to flush their spent chemicals down the sewer. Of course, that stopped. EPA, of course, said no more flushing of chemicals of any sort down the sewers because they used, I believe it was potassium cyanide as their cleaning agent before they did plating. And so to take it away, as a guy who told me, I know him quite well here in Brooklyn, and he said to remove the chemicals and send chemicals became so costly that it did not pay to stay in business. So these platers, unfortunately, are all gone. I assume out maybe for specialized electronic work and all where they have to do plating still or some sort of copper plating, whatever. I guess it's most likely out there in Silicon Valley, Dick, over.
Or in Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City has some more lax rules along that line, and maybe their particular water table for various geological reasons, is more protected. When I visited the electro, I'm trying to think of the name of the, can't think of the name of the division of Edo that owns a facility in Salt Lake City. They get involved with some pretty exotic chemistry. And I think they're, well, in that particular part of the country, carrying away toxic waste is nowhere near as expensive as it is in a metro area like New York City. If you want to have somebody, a contractor, remove toxic waste from your facility in one of the five boroughs, I don't know where in the world they got to take it, but I bet you they got to take it 1,000 miles away, and as such, you're going to pay a lot. Whether they dump it out at sea or find some very rural piece of land where they're allowed to dump it on temporarily, that's one approach. Another approach is to take it to some kind of a processing center that changes the toxicity. Your sewage treatment plants are doing all kinds of things to make the effluent much more friendly, and you can put it back into the environment, and they get fertilizer and other byproducts out of that. And so I guess when it comes to toxic chemical waste, there are processing centers that can recover some of the chemistry so you can reuse it. But obviously, that's all expensive. If you and I were running a plating house, and in the old days we could just dump it down the sewer, that's probably 10 times cheaper than bringing the stuff to a processing center or an approved waste dump place. So, I guess you and I are slowly concluding that because of the cost of doing the business, there's probably none in the metro area anymore. And are they allowed in Silicon Valley? Even there, California's got some very strict rules. I'm not sure, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find that ROHS, Removal of Hazardous Substances, R-O-H-S, that those rules first came about in California. And as such, on modern-day electronics, to a certain degree, you're no longer allowed to use lead-bearing solder because lead is considered a toxic material. However, we're all discovering that the solder that doesn't have lead in it is very difficult to use. It's got some nasty side effects. It doesn't give you very good joints. and it gives you latent failure problems. There are now a number of departments of defense that will say you will not ship us Rojas